It is a gift to be with you, Lake Burien, this morning. Well, sort of with you. I'm in your sanctuary recording this message a couple of days beforehand and really excited. I was actually reminded of my childhood. I was raised by a single mom who worked a lot because she was a single mom. And so I had these two imaginary friends, Frank and Pete, and they were truly my closest companions growing up, my best friends, faithful till the end, never left me, even though they were imaginary. So to this morning or this afternoon as I'm preaching this, I kind of think of them in the crowd, Pete and Frank as my friends as I do this sermon for you. It was great when Lena asked me because I'm doing a lot of work on the Gospel of Mark right now, actually speaking a couple other places about the Gospel of Mark. And I love the Gospel of Mark for many different reasons. One of the reasons is because I think it begins to challenge the idea of who is actually in charge. And I think we'll get to that today. But just a little bit of prep work before we get into the actual text, which is Mark, the 12th chapter, the 13th through the 17th verse, the question about paying taxes. And I'm sure we're all interested in that. Gospels are interesting creatures because they're not just biographical sketches. They're actually the work of an artist or a creator trying to sculpt or paint a picture of Jesus for theological purposes. In fact, how I tell my students the sort of frame of gospel is it's the past story of Jesus with present implications. So knowing the dynamics of what's happening in Mark is very important as we move forward. For lack of a whole class, I just want us to pay attention to the fact that Jesus is born around 2 to 0, either before the Common Era or right at the beginning of the Common Era. Jesus dies around 33 of the Common Era. Paul's letters are written in that 40 to 60 time, and Mark is our first gospel that is documented. Most scholars agree that Mark is the first one written somewhere in the 60s, and then we've got Matthew and Luke somewhere around the 80s of the Common Era, and probably 90 years after the life of Jesus, or 60 years after the life of Jesus, we see the Gospel of John coming on the scene. So those contexts are very specific as we begin to unwrap this gospel. Specifically to Mark, Mark is an interesting gospel because we sort of learn how to be a disciple from the disciples' negative example. Jesus starts off his gospel by asking the disciples if they're dumb. And then he says, if you don't understand this, you're not going to understand anything else. But then he has to go on to explain what he's trying to say in these seed parables. And we see over and over and over the Gospel of Mark, the disciples misunderstanding the purposes of Jesus to the point where in the 8th chapter, you begin to see Jesus really clarifying his vision. And it's Peter that actually, for lack of a better term, corrects Jesus and says, no, that's not your mission. And Jesus says the very kind words, get behind me, Satan. A couple of things that are really interesting about this gospel that I just want to pay attention to. It's a fast-paced gospel. Immediately is used 43 times in the gospel. There's a real emphasis on the passion, and I think that that's because it's written in the shadow of empire. What does it mean to be Caesar, or what does it mean to be king according to Jesus, are very different things. So there's an emphasis on the passion. There's also this interesting messianic secret. Jesus does all these miraculous things through Mark's gospel, but more often, in fact, most of the time, he tells people not to tell anyone because he has to clarify what it truly means to be a Messiah. It's only the demoniac who's healed and delivered in the borderlands outside of Jewish territory that's told, go tell your community. Everybody within the Jewish context is actually cautioned to not tell because they will misread it, possibly because they get it conflated with empire. There's an emphasis on discipleship, but it's discipleship as the way in contrast to the way of what is happening there in relationship to empire and Rome. And throughout Mark's gospel, more than any other, there is this intense conflict. Like I said, Mark is written about 66 CE. There's this Of the Common Era, there's this significant revolt of zealots and Pharisees. It is squashed by the Roman Empire. This is the loss of the Second Temple around 70 years or 50 years after Jesus. Romans have destroyed the Second Temple. And there's this, I think in sort of Western evangelicalism, there's this need to personalize or make it a personal devotional in an effort to suppress what I would argue the deepening contradictions between what does it mean to be a citizen of Rome and what does it mean to be a follower of Jesus. So according to a great commentary that I love, Ched Myers, he says, there's three dynamics happening all through Mark's gospel. Whose baptism is a question of what religion do we follow? Whose vineyard is a question of what do we do economically in relationship to the gospel? And this pericope, Linda loves when I say pericope, this pericope here that has to do with coins and image, it's about politics and identity and power. So let me just read the text to you quickly, and then we'll talk about it for just a couple of minutes. In Mark 12, the 13th through the 17th verse says this. Then they sent some of the Pharisees and some of the Herodians to trap Jesus. As I wrote in my little notes, they've gone fishing trying to find Jesus or trying to trap Jesus in an argument. Find Jesus, and this is what they said. They came and said to him, Teacher, we know that you are sincere and show deference to no one, for you do not regard people with partiality, but you teach the way of God. This idea of the way is very important. The way of God in accordance with the truth. Is it lawful to pay taxes to the emperor or not? All of a sudden Jesus is pushed into a political corner. Should we be paying taxes to Rome, who actually is running the area that you're in right now, Jesus? Anyway, he goes on to say this. Should we pay taxes to them or is it lawful to pay taxes to Rome? Excuse me. Should we pay them or should we not? But knowing Jesus, knowing their hypocrisy, he said to them, why are you putting me to the test? Bring to me a denarii and let me see it. So Jesus grabs the coin and looks at it. They brought him one. And he says to them, whose head and whose title is on this coin? They answered, the emperor. Jesus said, well, give to the emperor what is the emperor's and give to God what is God's. The text says they were amazed and they walked away. I would argue that this has everything to do with image bearing. This is the text that begins to challenge, who do you look like? Who do you want to emulate? Who do you belong to? So Jesus very naturally says, this is a coin. It has Caesar's image. It obviously belongs to Caesar. Give it to Caesar's. So this is where I want to play with the text a little bit. What does this mean to be an image bearer, and whose image do we bear? Now, what's interesting about this dynamic of image bearing is this. In the Roman Empire, the Caesar was like a god. He would die to become divinity, but he was the only one that bore the image of God. Now, this is very different than the Christian and Hebrew tradition that we all are familiar with when we can go back to Genesis 1 and we begin to realize that all of humanity bears the image of God. All of us together, and I would say together collectively, bear the image of God. We are created in the likeness of God. And so I just want to spend a little bit of time talking about that. In fact, Phyllis Trible, in her brilliant commentary, God and the Rhetoric of Sexuality, says that actually the linguistic sort of description of what's happening there is very important, because it's not saying that men or female or male and female. It's actually saying God actually argues, or God actually calls his image into existence in the rich variety of male and female. In fact, Karl Barth proposed this, that the image of God refers to the God-giving capacity of all human beings in their co-humanity and their rich variety to bear the image of God. Now, the Greeks would argue that somehow our substance is the same of God. We are like God in our substance. But Barth pushes back on the Greek understanding, and he says, no, we're not like God in some sort of substantive way, in our appearance, in our freedom, or even in our rationale. We know that God is very different than us. God is transcendent, other. But Barth argued that we are like God in how we relate to each other and relate to him. In our relationality is how we image or reflect what God is like. So we are not only image bearers in that way, we truly are image sharers, sharing the image of God with all of humanity. And what's interesting about this is as image sharers, Jesus begins to tell us, how do we understand this image bearing quality? Jesus says this in John. He says, I claim to do only what I see my Father does. This idea of image bearing is a deeply relational quality that connects us not only to God, but I would argue it connects us to ourselves, or to each other, excuse me. We actually bear the image, but nobody bears the image by oneself. It is a relational image. In fact, I would argue that much of our Trinitarian theology, how we understand God in three persons, is this dynamic of relational image bearing. In fact, the image is deeply, deeply challenged by this idea of self-sufficiency. You see, the Caesar thought that he bore the image all by himself. And what Jesus is challenging is this idea of, if that's what bears his image, give it to him. But whose image do you bear? In fact, this is the beauty of bearing an image together as a community. We as image bearers are not limited by our limitation. I love that. I love the idea that my limitation actually makes room for your capacity. If we understand this Karl Barth idea that all of us as humanity together collectively bears the image of God, we become relationally connected in such a way that we can depend on the gifts and the skills of others to exemplify parts of God that we don't bear ourselves. In fact, I would even argue that it's in our imitation of each other we begin to communicate some of the anthropological things around the image of God, that we are not only like each other, but we define ourselves by imitating others. This is why Dietrich Bonhoeffer said in his book Life Together, the Jesus in you is bigger than the Jesus in me. Dietrich understood that his own identity, his orientation, his ethnicity actually limited him from showing the whole picture of God. And it's as we work collectively together do we begin to show an image that's different than the image of Caesar, that's an image of the divine. It's also important to say, when I said that we imitate each other, we are borrowers of each other's image. You ever notice that? Every single advertising strategy is about putting something really cool in the hands of somebody really awesome, and that means we will imitate it. We will buy into it. So it's not just a question of image bearing, but it's an image of image sharing, and it's imitating. It's Jesus in this text, I believe, really challenging us to say, who will you imitate? Who do you want to look like? If you want to look like Caesar, give the coin to Caesar's. It's obviously his. It has his picture on it. But if you're from God, do you want to imitate the empire, or do you want to imitate an alternative image? I know, and everybody, Pat was all excited. She's like, oh, Ron's going to tell us not to pay taxes. We were all talking about, like, what is going to happen here politically? Well, there is a political implication to this message, and that is we become what we imitate. This is the writer of Isaiah that says we become what we desire, or we become what we worship. This idea of sharing an image means that we have to be cautious and intentional about who and what we want to imitate in the world, and what images we want to renounce or to step away from. If all of us together borrow our image from and with each other, the question really becomes in this text, I believe, and this is getting close to the end here. This is the question that we want to ask ourselves. Do we want to look like the empire, or do we want to reflect the image of God in its rich variety in all of humanity? As I was thinking about this text and reflecting it and truly spending a whole bunch of time with it, because Lena asked me a couple of weeks ago and it's been fun to just sit with it, I realized I don't want to look like Caesar. I don't want to look like Joe Biden. I don't want to look like Donald Trump. I want to look like Lena Thompson in the gentle way she coaxes a community towards their best. I want to look like Tally Harrison in the way he asks complex questions that lend themselves to better conversation. I want to look like Celie and how she activates and agitates for her community. I want to look like Hala, who knows how to extend hospitality in a way that creates empty space where the guest can discover who they are supposed to be and they're not dictated or manipulated by the host. You see, Jesus in this text says something very simple. Give to the emperor the things that are the emperor's, and give to God the things that are God's. The real question is, to whom do we belong? Do we belong to Jesus and to the community of faith that shapes us and molds us, or do we belong to the government? What do you want to look like? And where do you want to borrow your image from? I pray that this community, together as a whole community, with all of their limitations and with all of their strengths, can together bear the image of God. Give to Caesar what's Caesar's, but give to God what's God's.